3. 1 year after Air France Flight 447 disappeared into the ocean, another Airbus, this one part of Qantas Airways, taxied onto a runway in Singapore, requested permission to begin the 8-hour flight to Sydney, and lifted into the bright morning sky. The Qantas plane flying that day had the same autoflight systems as the Air France airplane that had crashed into the sea, but the pilots were very different. Even before Captain Richard Champion de Crepney stepped on board Qantas Flight 32, he was drilling his crew in the mental models he expected them to use. "I want us to envision the first thing we'll do if there's a problem," he told his co-pilots as they rode in a van from the Fairmont Hotel to Singapore Changi Airport. "Imagine there's an engine failure. Where's the first place you'll look?" The pilots took turns describing where they would turn their eyes. De Crepney conducted this same conversation prior to every flight. His co-pilots knew to expect it. He quizzed them on what screens they would stare at during an emergency, where their hands would go if an alarm sounded, whether they would turn their heads to the left or stare straight ahead. The reality of a modern aircraft is that it's a 250,000 sensors and computers that sometimes can't tell the difference between garbage and good sense, de Crepney later told me. He's a brusque Australian, a cross between Crocodile Dundee and General Patton. "That's why we have human pilots. It's our job to think about what might happen instead of what is." After the crew's visualization session, de Crepney laid down some rules. "Everyone has a responsibility to tell me if you disagree with my decisions or think I'm missing anything." "Mark," he said, gesturing to a co-pilot, "if you see everyone looking down, I want you to look up. If we're all looking up, you look down. We'll all probably make at least one mistake this flight. You're each responsible for catching them." 440 passengers were preparing to board the plane when the pilots entered the cockpit. De Crepney, like all Qantas aviators, was required to undergo a yearly review of his flying skills. And so, on that day, there were two extra pilots in the cockpit, observers drawn from the airline's most experienced ranks. The review wasn't perfunctory. If de Crepney stumbled, it could trigger his early retirement. As the pilots took their seats, one of the observers sat near the center of the cockpit, where standard operating procedure usually positioned the second officer. De Crepney frowned. He had expected the observer to sit off to the side, out of the way. He had a picture in his mind of how his cockpit ought to be arranged. De Crepney faced the evaluator. "Where do you intend to sit?" he asked. "In this seat between you and Matt," the observer said. "I've got a problem with that," de Crepney said. "You're inhibiting my crew." The cockpit went silent. This kind of confrontation was not supposed to happen between a captain and the observers. "Rich, I can't see you if I sit in Mark's seat," the observer said. "How can I check you?" "That's your problem," de Crepney replied. "I want my crew together, and I want Mark in your seat." "Richard, you're being unreasonable," the second observer said. "I have a flight to command, and I want my crew operating properly," said de Crepney. "Look, Richard," replied the evaluator. "If it helps, I promise I'll be the second officer if I have to be." De Crepney paused. He wanted to show his crew they could question his decisions. He wanted them to know he was paying close attention to what they had to say and was sensitive to what they thought. Just as teams at Google and Saturday Night Live need to be able to critique one another without fear of punishment, de Crepney wanted his crew to see that he encouraged them to disagree. "Fantastic," de Crepney said to the evaluator. "Once he said he would be the second officer, it fit into the plan I had in my mind," de Crepney later told me. Inside the cockpit, de Crepney turned back to the controls and began moving Qantas Flight 32 away from the gate. The plane sped down the runway and lifted into the air. At 2,000 feet, de Crespigny activated the plane's autopilot. The sky was cloudless, the conditions perfect. At 7,400 feet, as de Crespigny was about to order the first officer to switch off the cabin seatbelt sign, he heard a boom. It was probably just a surge of high-pressure air moving through the engine, he thought. Then there was another, even louder crash, followed by what sounded like thousands of marbles being thrown against the hull. A red alarm flashed on de Crespigny's instrument panel, and a siren blared in the cockpit. Investigators would later determine that an oil fire inside one of the left jets had caused a massive turbine disc to detach from the drive shaft, shear into three pieces, and shoot outward, shattering the engine. Two of the larger fragments from that explosion punched holes in the left wing, one of them large enough for a man to fit through. Hundreds of smaller shards, exploding like a cluster bomb, cut through electrical wires, fuel hoses, a fuel tank, and hydraulic pumps. The underside of the wing looked as though it had been machine-gunned. Long strips of metal were bending off the left wing and whipping in the air. The plane began to shake. De Crespigny reached over to decrease the aircraft's speed, the standard reaction for an emergency of this kind, but when he pushed a button, the autothrust didn't respond. Alarms started popping up on his computer display. Engine 2 was on fire. Engine 3 was damaged. There was no data at all for engines 1 and 4. The fuel pumps were failing. The hydraulics, pneumatics, and electrical systems were almost inoperative. Fuel was leaking from the left wing in a wide fan. The damage would later be described as one of the worst mid-air mechanical disasters in modern aviation. De Crespigny radioed Singapore Air Traffic Control. QF-32, engine 2 appears failed, he said. Heading 150, maintaining 7,400 feet. We'll keep you informed and we'll get back to you in 5 minutes. Less than 10 seconds had passed since the first boom. De Crespigny cut power to the left wing and began anti-fire protocols. The plane stopped vibrating for a moment. Inside the cockpit, alarms were blaring. The pilots were quiet. In the cabin, panicked passengers rushed to their windows and pointed at the screens embedded in their seats, which, unfortunately, were broadcasting the view of the damaged wing from a camera mounted in the tail. The men in the cockpit began responding to prompts from the plane's computers, speaking to one another in short, efficient sentences. De Crespigny looked at his display and saw that 21 of the plane's 22 major systems were damaged or completely disabled. The functioning engines were rapidly deteriorating, and the left wing was losing the hydraulics that made steering possible. Within minutes, the plane had become capable of only the smallest changes in thrust and the tiniest navigational adjustments. No one was certain how long it would stay in the air. One of the co-pilots looked up from his controls. "I think we should turn back," he said. Turning the airplane around in order to head back to the airport was risky. But at their current heading, they were getting farther away from the runway with each second. De Crespigny told the control tower they would return. He began turning the plane in a long, slow arc. "Request climb to 10,000 feet, De Crespigny radioed to air traffic control. "No!" his co-pilot shouted. They quickly explained their concerns. Climbing higher might strain the engines. The change in altitude could cause fuel to leak faster. They wanted to stay low and keep the plane flat. De Crespigny had flown more than 15,000 hours as a pilot and had practiced disaster scenarios like this in dozens of simulators. He had envisioned moments like this hundreds of times. He had a picture in his mind of how to react, and it involved getting higher so he would have more options. Every instinct told him to gain altitude, but each mental model has gaps. It was his crew's job to find them. Qantas 32, de Krupny radioed. Disregard the climb to 10,000 feet. We will maintain 7,400 feet. For the next 20 minutes, the men in the cockpit dealt with an increasing number of alarms and emergencies. The plane's computer displayed step-by-step solutions to each problem, but as the issues cascaded, the instructions became so overwhelming that no one was certain how to prioritize or where to focus. De Krupny felt himself getting drawn into a cognitive tunnel. One computer checklist told the pilots to transfer fuel between the wings in order to balance the plane's weight. Stop! De Krupny shouted as a co-pilot reached to comply with the screen's command. Should we be transferring fuel out of the good right wing into the leaking left wing? A decade earlier, a flight in Toronto had nearly crashed after the crew had inadvertently dumped their fuel by transferring it into a leaky engine. The pilots agreed to ignore the order. De Krupny slumped in his chair. He was trying to visualize the damage, trying to keep track of his dwindling options, trying to construct a mental picture of the plane as he learned more and more about what was wrong. Throughout this crisis, De Krupny and the other pilots had been building mental models of the Airbus inside their heads. Everywhere they looked, however, they saw a new alarm, another system failing, more blinking lights. De Krupny took a breath, removed his hand from the controls, and placed them in his lap. Let's keep this simple, he said to his co-pilots. We can't transfer fuel, we can't jettison it. The trim tank fuel is stuck in the tail, and the transfer tanks are useless. So forget the pumps, forget the other 8 tanks, forget the total fuel quantity gauge. We need to stop focusing on what's wrong and start paying attention to what's still working. On cue, one of the co-pilots began ticking off things that were still operational. 2 of 8 hydraulic pumps still functioned. The left wing had no electricity, but the right wing had some power. The wheels were intact, and the co-pilots believed De Krupny could pump the brakes at least once before they failed. The first airplane De Krupny had ever flown was a Cessna, one of the single-engine, nearly non-computerized planes that hobbyists loved. A Cessna is a toy compared to an Airbus, of course, but every plane at its core has the same components: a fuel system, flight controls, brakes, landing gear. What if, De Krupny thought to himself, I imagine this plane as a Cessna? What would I do then? That moment is really the turning point. Barbara Burian, a research psychologist at NASA who has studied Qantas Flight 32, told me. When De Krupny decided to take control of the mental model he was applying to the situation, rather than react to the computer, it shifted his mindset. Now he's deciding where to direct his focus instead of relying on instructions. Most of the time, when information overload occurs, we're not aware it's happening, and that's why it's so dangerous, Burian said. So really good pilots push themselves to do a lot of what-if exercises before an event, running through scenarios in their heads. That way, when an emergency happens, they have models they can use. This shift in mindset, what if I imagine this plane as a Cessna, is what never occurred, tragically, inside the cockpit of Air France Flight 447. The French pilots never reached for a new mental model to explain what was going on. But when the mental model of the Airbus inside De Krupny's head started coming apart under the weight of all the new emergencies, he decided to replace it with something new. He began imagining the plane as a Cessna, which allowed him to figure out where he should turn his attention and what he could ignore. De Krupny asked one of his co-pilots to calculate how much runway they would need. Inside his head, De Krupny was envisioning the landing of an oversized Cessna. Picturing it that way helped me simplify things, he told me. I had a picture in my head that contained the basics, and that's all I needed to land the plane. If de Crespigny hit everything just right, the co-pilot said, the plane would require 3,900 meters of asphalt. The longest runway at Singapore Changi was 4,000 meters. If they overshot, the craft would buckle as its wheels hit the grassy fields and sand dunes. Let's do this, de Crespigny said. The plane began descending towards Singapore Changi Airport. At 2,000 feet, de Crespigny looked up from his panel and saw the runway. At 1,000 feet, an alarm inside the cockpit began screaming, "Speed! Speed! Speed!" The plane was at risk of stalling. De Crespigny's eyes flicked between the runway and his speed indicators. He could see the Cessna's wings in his mind. He delicately nudged the throttle, increasing the speed slightly, and the alarm stopped. He brought the nose up a touch because that's what the picture in his mind told him to do. "Confirm the fire services on standby," a co-pilot radioed the control tower. "Affirm, we have the emergency services on standby," a voice replied. The plane was descending at 14 feet per second. The maximum certified speed the undercarriage could absorb was only 12 feet per second. But there were no other options now. 50, a computerized voice said. 40. De Crespigny pulled back slightly on his stick. 30. 20. A metallic voice erupted. "Stall! Stall! Stall!" The Cessna in de Crespigny's mind was still sailing toward the runway, ready to land as he had hundreds of times before. It wasn't stalling. He ignored the alarm. The rear wheels of the Airbus touched the ground, and de Crespigny pushed his stick forward, forcing the front wheels onto the tarmac. The brakes would work only once, so de Crespigny pushed the pedal as far as it would go and held it down. The first 1,000 meters of the runway blurred past. At the 2,000-meter mark, de Crespigny thought they might be slowing. The end of the runway was rushing toward them through the windshield, grass and sand dunes growing bigger the closer they got. As the plane neared the end of the runway, the metal began to groan. The wheels left long skid marks on the asphalt. Then the plane slowed, shuddered, and came to a stop with 100 meters to spare. Investigators would later deem Qantas Flight 32 the most damaged Airbus A380 ever to land safely. Multiple pilots would try to recreate de Crespigny's recovery in simulators and would fail every time. When Qantas Flight 32 finally came to a rest, the lead flight attendant activated the plane's announcement system. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "welcome to Singapore. The local time is 5 minutes to midday on Thursday, 4th November, and I think you'll agree that was one of the nicest landings we have experienced for a while." De Crespigny returned home a hero. Today, Qantas Flight 32 is taught in flight schools and psychology classrooms as a case study of how to maintain focus during an emergency. It is cited as one of the prime examples of how mental models can put even the most dire situations within our control. Mental models help us by providing a scaffold for the torrent of information that constantly surrounds us. Models help us choose where to direct our attention so we can make decisions, rather than just react. The Air France pilots didn't have strong mental models, and so when tragedy struck, they didn't know where to focus. De Crespigny and his co-pilots, in contrast, were telling themselves stories and testing and revising them even before they stepped onto the plane, and so they were prepared when disaster occurred. We may not recognize how situations within our own lives are similar to what happens within an airplane cockpit, but think for a moment about the pressures you face each day. If you are in a meeting and the CEO suddenly asks you for an opinion, your mind is likely to snap from passive listening to active involvement. And if you're not careful, a cognitive tunnel might prompt you to say something you regret. If you are juggling multiple conversations and tasks at once and an important email arrives, reactive thinking can cause you to type a reply before you've really thought out what you want to say. So what's the solution? If you want to do a better job of paying attention to what really matters, of not getting overwhelmed and distracted by the constant flow of emails and conversations and interruptions that are part of every day, of knowing where to focus and what to ignore, get into the habit of telling yourself stories. Narrate your life as it's occurring. And then when your boss suddenly asks a question or an urgent note arrives and you have only minutes to reply, the spotlight inside your head will be ready to shine the right way. To become genuinely productive, we must take control of our attention. We must build mental models that put us firmly in charge. When you're driving to work, force yourself to envision your day. While you're sitting in a meeting or at lunch, describe to yourself what you're seeing and what it means. Find other people to hear your theories and challenge them. Get in a pattern of forcing yourself to anticipate what's next. If you are a parent, anticipate what your children will say at the dinner table. Then you'll notice what goes unmentioned, or if there's a stray comment that you should see as a warning sign. "You can't delegate thinking," de Crepney told me. "Computers fail. Checklists fail. Everything can fail. But people can't. We have to make decisions. And that includes deciding what deserves our attention. The key is forcing yourself to think. As long as you're thinking, you're halfway home." Chapter 4. Goal Setting. SMART Goals, Stretch Goals, and the Yom Kippur War. In October 1972, one of Israel's brightest generals, the 44-year-old Eli Za'ira, was promoted to oversee the Directorate of Military Intelligence, the agency responsible for warning the country's leaders if its enemies were about to attack. Za'ira's appointment came half a decade after the 1967 Six-Day War, in which Israel, in a stunning preemptive strike, had captured the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, and other territory from Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. That war had demonstrated Israel's military superiority, more than doubled the amount of territory the country controlled, and had humiliated the nation's enemies. But it also instilled a deep anxiety among Israeli citizens that the country's antagonists would eventually seek revenge. Those fears were legitimate. Since the Six-Day War had ended, generals in Egypt and Syria had repeatedly threatened to reclaim their lost territory, and Arab leaders, in fiery speeches, had vowed to push the Jewish state into the sea. As Israel's enemies became increasingly bellicose, the nation's lawmakers sought to calm public worries by asking the military to provide regular forecasts on the likelihood of attack. However, the assessments provided by the Directorate of Military Intelligence were often contradictory and inconclusive, a mishmash of opinions predicting various levels of risk. Analysts sent conflicting memos and flip-flopped week to week. Some weeks, lawmakers were warned to be on alert, and then nothing would happen. Policymakers were called to meetings and told that a risk might be materializing, but no one could say for sure. Army units were ordered to ready their defenses, and then those orders would be countermanded with no explanation why. As a result, Israeli politicians and the public became increasingly frustrated. Army reservists constituted 80% of the Israeli Defense Force's ground troops. There was a constant nervousness that hundreds of thousands of citizens would be required, at a moment's notice, to abandon their families and rush to the borders. People wanted to know if the risk of another war was real, and if so, how much forewarning they would get. Elie Zaira was appointed to head the Directorate of Military Intelligence, in part, to address those uncertainties. He was a former paratrooper known for his sophistication and political savvy. He had risen quickly through Israel's military establishment, even spending a few years as an assistant to Moshe Dayan, the hero of the Six-Day War. When Zaira took over the directorate, he told the Israeli parliament that his job was simple: to provide decision-makers with an estimate as clear and as sharp as possible. His chief goal, he said, was to make sure alarms were raised only when the risks of war were real. His method for achieving this clarity was ordering his military analysts to use a strict formula in assessing Arab intentions. He had helped develop these criteria, which became known among intelligence officials as the concept. Zaira argued that during the Six-Day War, Israel's superior air power, arsenal of long-range missiles, and battlefield dominance had so thoroughly embarrassed their enemies that no country would attack again unless they had an air force powerful enough to protect ground troops from Israeli jets and Scud missiles capable of hitting Tel Aviv. Without those two conditions being met, Zaira said, the threats of Arab leaders were nothing more than words. 6 months after Zaira assumed his post, the nation had an opportunity to test his concept. In the spring of 1973, large numbers of Egyptian troops began amassing along the Suez Canal, which was the border between Egypt and the Israeli-controlled Sinai Peninsula. Israel's spies warned that Egypt planned to invade in mid-May. On April 18th, Israel's prime minister, Golda Meir, gathered her top advisors in a closed-door meeting. The military chief of staff and the head of the Mossad both said an Egyptian attack was a real possibility and the nation needed to prepare. Meir turned to Zaira for his assessment. He disagreed with his colleagues, he said. Egypt still didn't have a powerful air force and possessed no missiles capable of reaching Tel Aviv. Egypt's leaders were merely rattling sabers to impress their countrymen. The odds of an invasion, he determined, were very low. Meir ultimately sided with her chief of staff and the Mossad. She ordered the military to make defensive preparations, and over the next month, the army readied itself for war. Soldiers built walls, outposts, and batteries along the 100-mile-long bank of the Suez Canal. In the Golan Heights, which bordered Syria, platoons launched practice shells and tanks rehearsed battle formations. Millions of dollars were spent and thousands of soldiers were prevented from taking leave. But the attack never materialized. Meir's government, chagrined at their overreaction, soon reversed their public declarations. In July of that year, Moshe Dayan, then Israel's defense minister, told Time magazine that it was unlikely a war would occur within the next decade. Zaira emerged from the affair, in the words of the historian Abraham Rabinovich, with his reputation and his self-confidence greatly enhanced. With alarm bells going off all around him and the nation's fate at stake, he had coolly maintained throughout the crisis that the probability of war was not only low, but very low, Rabinovich wrote. It was his task, he would say, to keep the national blood pressure down and not sound alarms unnecessarily. Otherwise, the reserves would be mobilized every couple of months with devastating effect on the economy and on morale. By the summer of 1973, Zaira had established himself as one of Israel's most influential leaders. He had assumed his new job with the goal of reducing needless anxiety, and had demonstrated that a disciplined approach could prevent wasteful second-guessing. The nation had wanted relief from the constant worries of an impending attack, and Zaira had provided it. His ascent to even more powerful positions seemed preordained. 2. Imagine you have been asked to complete a questionnaire. Your assignment is to rate how strongly you agree or disagree with 42 statements, including, I believe orderliness and organization are among the most important characteristics. I find that establishing a consistent routine enables me to enjoy life more. I like to have friends who are unpredictable. I prefer interacting with people whose opinions are very different from my own. My personal space is usually messy and disorganized. It's annoying to listen to someone who cannot seem to make up his or her mind. A team of researchers at the University of Maryland first published this test in 1994, and since then it has become a staple of personality exams. At first glance, the questions seem designed to measure someone's preference for personal organization and their comfort with alternate viewpoints. And, in fact, researchers have found that this exam helps identify people who are more decisive and self-assured, and that those traits are correlated with general success in life. Determined and focused people tend to work harder and get tasks done more promptly. They stay married longer and have deeper networks of friends. They often have higher-paying jobs. But this questionnaire is not intended to test personal organization. Rather, it's designed to measure a personality trait known as the need for cognitive closure, which psychologists define as the desire for a confident judgment on an issue, any confident judgment, as compared to confusion and ambiguity. Most people respond to this exam, which is called the need for closure scale, by demonstrating a preference for a mix of order and chaos in their lives. They say they prize orderliness, but admit to having messy desks. They say they are annoyed by indecision, but also have unreliable friends. However, some people, about 20% of test takers, and many of the most accomplished people who have completed the exam, show a higher-than-average preference for personal organization, decisiveness, and predictability. They tend to disdain flighty friends and ambiguous situations. These people have a high emotional need for cognitive closure. The need for cognitive closure, in many settings, can be a great strength. People who have a strong urge for closure are more likely to be self-disciplined and seen as leaders by their peers. An instinct to make a judgment and then stick with it forestalls needless second-guessing and prolonged debate. The best chess players typically display a high need for closure, which helps them focus on a specific problem during stressful moments, rather than obsessing over past mistakes. All of us crave closure to some degree, and that's good, because a basic level of personal organization is a prerequisite for success. What's more, making a decision and moving on to the next question feels productive. It feels like progress. But there are risks associated with a high need for closure. When people begin craving the emotional satisfaction that comes from making a decision, when they require a sensation of being productive in order to stay calm, they are more likely to make hasty decisions and less likely to reconsider an unwise choice. The need for closure introduces a bias into the judgmental process, a team of researchers wrote in Political Psychology in 2003. A high need for closure has been shown to trigger close-mindedness, authoritarian impulses, and a preference for conflict over cooperation. Individuals with a high need for closure may display considerable cognitive impatience or impulsivity. They may leap to judgment on the basis of inconclusive evidence and exhibit rigidity of thought and reluctance to entertain views different from their own. The authors of the Need for Closure Scale, R.E.A. Kruglansky and Donna Webster, wrote in 1996. Put differently, an instinct for decisiveness is great until it's not. When people rush toward decisions simply because it makes them feel like they are getting something done, missteps are more likely to occur. Researchers describe the need for closure as having multiple components. There is the need to seize a goal, as well as a separate urge to freeze on an objective once it has been selected. Decisive people have an instinct to seize on a choice when it meets a minimum threshold of acceptability. This is a useful impulse because it helps us commit to projects rather than endlessly debating questions or second-guessing ourselves into a state of paralysis. However, if our urge for closure is too strong, we freeze on our goals and yearn to grab that feeling of productivity at the expense of common sense. Individuals with a high need for cognitive closure may deny, reinterpret, or suppress information inconsistent with the preconceptions on which they are frozen, the political psychology researchers wrote. When we're overly focused on feeling productive, we become blind to details that should give us pause. It feels good to achieve closure. Sometimes, though, we become unwilling to sacrifice that sensation even when it's clear we're making a mistake. On October 1, 1973, 6 months after Zaira predicted that the odds of war were very low, and 5 days before Yom Kippur, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar, a young Israeli intelligence officer named Binyamin Simontov sent his commanders in Tel Aviv a warning. He was receiving reports from the Sinai that large numbers of Egyptian convoys were arriving at night. Egypt's military was digging up minefields they had installed along the border, making it easier for them to move material across the canal. There were stockpiles of boats and bridge-making supplies on the Egyptian side of the border. It was the largest buildup of equipment that soldiers on the front lines had seen. Zaira had received a number of reports like this in the preceding week, but they didn't cause him much concern. "Remember the concept," he counseled his lieutenants. Egypt still didn't have enough planes or missiles to defeat Israel. And besides, Zaira had other things to focus on, most notably the cultural transformation he was pushing through the Directorate of Military Intelligence. In the midst of remaking the military's approach to threat analysis, Zaira was also ridding his agency of its propensity for endless debate. Henceforth, he had declared, intelligence officers would be evaluated on the clarity of their recommendations. Both Zaira and his chief lieutenant lacked the patience for long and open discussions and regarded them as bullshit, the historians Yuri Bar-Joseph and Abraham Rabinovich wrote. Zaira would humiliate officers who, in his opinion, came unprepared for meetings. At least once he was heard to say that those officers who estimated in spring 1973 that a war was likely should not expect promotion. Though internal debates were tolerated to a point, once an estimate was formulated, everyone was committed to it, and no one was allowed to express a different estimate outside the organization. The directorate had to lead by example, Zaira declared. He had been appointed to provide answers, not prolong debates. When one of Zaira's subordinates, concerned about the latest reports of Egyptian troop movements, asked to mobilize a handful of reservists to help analyze what was going on, he received a phone call. "Yoel, listen well," Zaira told the memo writer. "It is intelligence's job to safeguard the nation's nerves, not to drive the public crazy." The request was denied. On October 2nd and 3rd, 1973, sightings of Egyptian troops increased. Then came word of activity on the border with Syria. Alarmed, the prime minister called another meeting. Zaira's division, once again, counseled that there was no reason to be concerned. Egypt and Syria had weak air forces. They had no missiles capable of hitting Tel Aviv. This time, the military experts who had disagreed with Zaira 6 months earlier followed his lead. I don't see a concrete danger in the near future, one general told the prime minister. My ear was troubled before the meeting, she later recounted in her memoirs, but the intelligence estimate eased her mind. She had chosen the right officials to bring the nation much-needed relief. 72 hours after Binyamin Simontov submitted his report, Israel's intelligence analysts learned that the Soviet Union had started an emergency airlift of Soviet advisors and their families out of Syria and Egypt. Intercepted telephone calls among Russian families revealed they had been ordered to hurry to the airport. Aerial photographs showed more tanks, artillery, and air defense guns massing along the Suez Canal and in the Syrian-controlled portions of the Golan Heights. On the morning of Friday, October 5th, 4 days after Simontov's report, a group of Israel's top military commanders, including Zaira, gathered in the office of Defense Minister Moshe Dayan. The hero of the Six-Day War was upset. The Egyptians had positioned 1,100 pieces of artillery along the Suez, and air reconnaissance showed massive numbers of troops. You people don't take the Arabs seriously enough, Dayan said. The chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces agreed. Earlier that morning, he had ordered the army to its highest alert since 1967. But Zaira had another explanation for the troop movements. The Egyptians were preparing their defenses in case Israel launched an invasion of its own. There were no new fighter jets in Egypt, he said. No Scud missiles. Arab leaders knew striking at Israel would be suicide. I don't see either the Egyptians or the Syrians attacking, Zaira said. Afterward, the meeting moved into the prime minister's office. She asked for an update. The military's chief of staff, aware that mobilizing Israel's reservists on the holiest Jewish holiday would draw fierce criticism, said, I still think that they're not going to attack, but we have no hard information. Then Zaira spoke. Concerns about the Egyptians and Syrians attacking, he said, were absolutely unreasonable. He even had a logical reason for the evacuation of Soviet advisors. Maybe the Russians think the Arabs are going to attack because they don't understand them well, he said. But the Israelis knew their neighbors better than that. Later that day, when Israeli generals briefed the prime minister's cabinet, Zaira reiterated that he believed there was a low probability of war. What they were seeing were defensive preparations or a military exercise, Zaira argued. Arab leaders weren't irrational. Having seized on an answer that Egypt and Syria knew they couldn't win and therefore wouldn't attack, Zaira was frozen, unwilling to reconsider the question. His goal of disciplined decision-making had been satisfied. The next morning was the first full day of Yom Kippur. Before daybreak, the head of the Mossad telephoned his colleagues to say that a well-connected source had told him Egypt would invade by nightfall. The message was delivered to the prime minister, as well as Dayan and the military's chief of staff. They all rushed to their offices as the sun rose. The odds of war, they believed, had just shifted. As Yom Kippur prayers began, Israel's streets were quiet. Families were gathered in homes and synagogues. Shortly after 10 o'clock, a full 6 days after enemy forces had started massing along Israeli borders, the military finally issued a partial call-up of reserves. Inside houses of worship, rabbis read hastily delivered lists with the names of people who needed to report for duty. By then, Egypt and Syria had been moving tanks and artillery into offensive range for weeks, but this was the first public hint that trouble might be near. At that moment, there were more than 150,000 enemy soldiers along Israel's borders, ready to attack from two directions, and another 500,000 soldiers waiting to follow the initial waves. Egypt and Syria had been coordinating their invasion plans for months. When confidential documents from that period were released decades later, they revealed that Egypt's president had assumed Israel knew what he was doing. How else could they interpret all the men and materiel being moved to the border? Meir called an emergency meeting of her cabinet for noon. She was pale and her eyes were downcast, the Times of Israel wrote in a reconstruction of that day. Her hair, normally neatly combed and pulled back, was disheveled, and she looked like she had not shut her eyes all night. She began with a detailed report of events over the past few days, the Arab deployment on the borders that had suddenly taken on ominous color, the hasty evacuation of the families of Soviet advisors from Egypt and Syria, the air photos, the insistence by military intelligence that there would be no war despite mounting evidence to the contrary. Meir announced her conclusion. An invasion of Israel was likely to occur, maybe as soon as within the next 6 hours. The ministers were stunned, the Times of Israel reported. They had not been made privy to the Arab buildup. Furthermore, they had been told for years that even in a worst-case situation, military intelligence would provide at least a 48-hour warning to call up the reserves before war broke out. Now they were being informed that a two-front war would occur in less than 6 hours. The reserves were only partially mobilized, and because of the holiday, it was unclear how quickly troops would be able to get to the front. The attack came even sooner than Meir expected. 2 hours after the cabinet meeting started, the first of 10,000 Egyptian shells began falling on the Sinai. At 4 p.m., 23,000 Egyptian soldiers crossed the Suez in the first wave of attack. By the end of the day, enemy forces were 2 miles into Israeli territory. They had killed 500 Israeli soldiers and were rapidly advancing toward the Israeli towns of Yamit and Avshalom, as well as an Israeli Air Force base. Meanwhile, on the other side of the country, Syria struck simultaneously, attacking the Golan Heights with soldiers, planes, and tanks. Over the next 24 hours, Egypt and Syria pushed deeper into the Sinai and the Golan as Israel scrambled to respond. Over 100,000 enemy troops were inside Israel's territory. It took 3 days to halt the Egyptian advance and 2 days to organize a counterstrike against Syria. Eventually, Israel's superior firepower asserted itself. Israeli soldiers drove the Syrian army back toward the border, forcing the retreating army to leave behind 1,000 of its 1,500 tanks. A few days later, Israeli defense forces began shelling the outskirts of Damascus. Then Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, hoping to take more territory in the Sinai, launched a risky offensive to capture 2 strategic passes deep inside the peninsula. The gamble failed. Israeli forces pushed the Egyptians backward. On October 15th, 9 days after Egypt invaded, Israel crossed the Suez Canal and began taking Egyptian land. Within the week, Egypt's Third Army, located along the banks of the Suez, was encircled, cut off by the Israelis from supplies and reinforcements. The Second Army, in the north, was almost completely surrounded as well. In the face of defeat, President Sadat demanded a ceasefire, and American and Soviet leaders pressured Israel to agree. Fighting stopped in late October, and the war formally ended on January 18, 1974. Israel had repelled the invasion, but at a huge cost. More than 10,000 Israelis were killed or wounded. As many as 30,000 Egyptians and Syrians are estimated to have died. "Something of ours was destroyed on Yom Kippur last year," an Israeli newspaper wrote on the first anniversary of the war. "The state was saved, true, but our faith was fractured, our trust damaged, our hearts deeply gouged, and an entire generation was nearly lost." Even a quarter century later, the Yom Kippur War remains the most traumatic phase in Israel's history. The historian P.R. Kumaraswamy wrote, "Today, the psychological scars of the invasion are still profound. Za'ira had set out with a goal of alleviating public anxiety, and the government had followed his lead. But in their eagerness to provide confident answers, to make decisive judgments and avoid ambiguity, those leaders had almost cost Israel its life." 3. 15 years later, and half a world away, General Electric, one of the largest companies on Earth, was thinking about very different kinds of goals when executives contacted an organizational psychologist from the University of Southern California and asked him for help figuring out why some factories had gone awry. It was the late 1980s, and GE was the second most valuable company in America, just behind Exxon. GE manufactured everything from light bulbs to jet engines, refrigerators to railway cars, and through its ownership of NBC, was in millions of homes with iconic shows such as Cheers, The Cosby Show, and L.A. Law. The company employed over 220,000 people, more than many U.S. cities had residents. One of the reasons GE was so successful, its executives boasted, was that it was so good at choosing goals. In the 1940s, GE had formalized a corporate goal-setting system that would eventually become a model around the world. By the 1960s, every GE employee was required to write out their objectives for the year in a letter to their manager. Simply put, historians at Harvard Business School wrote in 2011, the manager's letter required a job holder to write a letter to his or her superior indicating what the goals for the next time frame were, how the goals would be met, and what standards were to be expected. When the superior accepted this letter, usually after editing and discussion, it became the work contract. By the 1980s, this system had evolved into a system of so-called SMART goals that every division and manager were expected to describe each quarter. These objectives had to be specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and based on a timeline. In other words, they had to be provably within reach and described in a way that suggested a concrete plan. If a goal didn't meet the SMART criteria, a manager had to resubmit a memo detailing their aims again and again until it was approved by upper management. It was about getting concrete, said William Conaty, who retired as GE's head of human resources in 2007. Your manager was always saying, "What's the specifics? What's the timeline? Prove to me this is realistic." The system worked because by the time we were done, you knew pretty clearly how things were going to unfold. The SMART mindset spread throughout GE's culture. There were SMART charts to help mid-level managers describe monthly goals and SMART worksheets to turn personal objectives into action plans. And the company's belief that SMART goals would work was rooted in good science. In the 1970s, a pair of university psychologists named Edwin Locke and Gary Latham had helped develop the SMART criteria through experiments scrutinizing the best way to set goals. In one experiment Latham conducted in 1975, researchers approached 45 of the most experienced and productive typists at a large corporation and measured how fast they produced text. The typists knew they were among the best in the company, but they had never measured how quickly they typed. The researchers found that, on average, each worker produced 95 lines of typewritten output per hour. Then the researchers gave each typist a specific goal based on their previous performance, such as 98 lines per hour, and showed the typists a system for easily measuring their hourly output. The researchers also had a conversation with each typist to make sure the goal was realistic and to adjust it if necessary, and they discussed what changes were required to make the objective achievable. They came up with a timeline for each person. The conversation didn't take long, say 15 minutes per person. But afterward, each typist knew exactly what to do and how to measure success. Each of them, put differently, had a SMART goal. Some of the researchers' colleagues said they didn't believe this would have an impact on the typist's performance. All the typists were professionals with years of experience. A 15-minute conversation should not make much of a difference to someone who has been typing 8 hours a day for 2 decades. But 1 week later, when the researchers measured typing speeds again, they found that the workers, on average, were completing 103 lines per hour. Another week later, 112 lines. Most of the typists had blown past the goals they had set. The researchers worried the workers were just trying to impress them, so they came back again 3 months later and quietly measured everyone's performance once more. They were typing just as fast, and some had gotten even faster. Some 400 laboratory and field studies show that specific, high goals lead to a higher level of task performance than do easy goals or vague, abstract goals such as the exhortation to do one's best, Locke and Latham wrote in 2006 in a review of goal-setting studies. In particular, objectives like SMART goals often unlock a potential that people don't even realize they possess. The reason, in part, is because goal-setting processes like the SMART system force people to translate vague aspirations into concrete plans. The process of making a goal specific and proving it is achievable involves figuring out the steps it requires, or shifting that goal slightly if your initial aims turn out to be unrealistic. Coming up with a timeline and a way to measure success forces a discipline onto the process that good intentions can't match. Making yourself break a goal into its SMART components is the difference between hoping something comes true and figuring out how to do it, Latham told me. GE's chief executive Jack Welch had long claimed that his insistence on SMART goals was one of the reasons the company's stock had more than tripled in 8 years. But forcing people to detail their goals with such specificity didn't mean every part of the company ran smoothly. Some divisions, despite setting SMART goals, never seemed to excel, or they would flip-flop from profits to losses, or seem to be growing and then suddenly fall apart. In the late 1980s, executives became particularly concerned about two divisions, a nuclear equipment manufacturer in North Carolina and a jet engine plant in Massachusetts, that had once been among the company's top performers but were now limping along. Executives initially suspected those divisions simply needed better defined objectives, so factory managers were asked to prepare memo after memo describing increasingly specific goals. Their responses were detailed, precise, and realistic. They met every SMART criterion. And yet, profits still fell. So a group of GE's internal consultants visited the nuclear factory in Wilmington, North Carolina. They asked employees to walk them through their weekly, monthly, and quarterly goals. One plant executive explained that his SMART objective was to prevent anti-nuclear protesters from harassing workers as they entered the plant because he felt it eroded morale. He had come up with a SMART plan to build a fence. The goal was specific and reasonable. The fence would be 50 feet long and 9 feet high. It had a timeline, it would be done by February, and it was achievable. They had a contractor ready to go. Next, the consultants went to the jet engine factory in Lynn, Massachusetts, and interviewed, among others, an administrative assistant who told them her SMART goal was ordering the factory's office supplies. She showed them a SMART chart with specific aims, order staplers, pens, and desk calendars, that were measurable by June, as well as achievable, realistic, and had a timeline. Place order on February 1st. Request update on March 15th. Many of the SMART goals the consultants found inside the factories were just as detailed and just as trivial. Workers spent hours making sure their objectives satisfied every SMART criterion, but spent much less time making sure the goals were worth pursuing in the first place. The nuclear factory's security guards had written extensive memos on the goal of theft prevention and had come up with a plan that basically consisted of searching everyone's bags every time they entered or exited the plant, which caused huge delays, said Brian Butler, one of the consultants. It might have stopped thefts, but it also destroyed the factory's productivity because everyone started leaving earlier each day so they could get home at a decent hour. Even the plant's senior executives, the consultants found, had fallen prey to an obsession with achievable but inconsequential goals and were focused on unimportant short-term objectives rather than more ambitious plans. When the consultants asked employees how they felt about GE's emphasis on SMART goals, they expected to hear complaints about the onerous bureaucracy. They anticipated people would say they wanted to think bigger, but were hamstrung by the incessant SMART demands. Instead, employees said they loved the SMART system. The administrative assistant who ordered office supplies said fulfilling those goals gave her a real sense of accomplishment. Sometimes, she said, she would write a SMART memo for a task she had already completed and then put it into her done folder. It made her feel so good. Researchers who have studied SMART goals and other structured methods of choosing objectives say this isn't unusual. Such systems, though useful, can sometimes trigger our need for closure in counterproductive ways. Aims such as SMART goals can cause a person to have tunnel vision, to focus more on expanding effort to get immediate results, Locke and Latham wrote in 1990. Experiments have shown that people with SMART goals are more likely to seize on the easiest tasks, to become obsessed with finishing projects, and to freeze on priorities once a goal has been set. You get into this mindset where crossing things off your to-do list becomes more important than asking yourself if you're doing the right things, said Latham. GE's executives weren't sure how to help the nuclear and jet engine factories. So in 1989, they asked a professor named Steve Kerr, the dean of faculty at the University of Southern California Business School, for help. Kerr was an expert in the psychology of goal setting, and he began by interviewing employees inside the nuclear factory. A lot of these people were really demoralized, he said. They had gone into nuclear energy because they wanted to change the world. Then Three Mile Island and Chernobyl happened, and the industry was getting protested every day and completely brutalized in the press. Setting short-term goals and achieving them, the plant's workers and executives told Kerr, was one of the few things they could feel good about at work. The only way to improve performance at the nuclear factory, Kerr thought, was to find a way to shake people out of their focus on short-term objectives. GE had recently started a series of meetings among top executives called workouts that were designed to encourage people to think about bigger ambitions and more long-term plans. Kerr helped expand those meetings to factories rank and file. The rules at workouts were simple. Employees could suggest any goal they thought GE ought to be pursuing. There were no SMART charts or memos. The concept was that nothing was off limits, Kerr told me. Managers had to approve or deny each suggestion quickly, often right away. And we wanted to make it easy to say yes, said Kerr. We thought if we could get people to identify the ambition first and then figure out the plan afterward, it would encourage bigger thinking. If an idea seemed half-baked, Kerr said, a manager should say yes, because even if the proposal is no better than what you're doing now, with the group's energy behind it, the plan will turn out great. Only after a goal was approved would everyone begin the formal process of determining how to make it realistic and achievable and all the other SMART criteria. At a workout inside the engine factory in Massachusetts, one worker told his bosses they were making a mistake by outsourcing construction of protective shields for their grinding machines. The factory could make them in-house for half the cost, he said. Then he unfurled a piece of butcher paper covered with scribbled blueprints. There was nothing smart about the man's proposal. It was unclear if it was realistic or achievable, or what measurements to apply. But when the factory's top manager looked at the butcher paper, he said, "I guess we'll try it out." 4 months later, after the blueprints had been professionally redrawn and the plan transformed into a series of SMART goals, the first prototype was installed. It cost $16,000, more than 80% less than the outsourced bid. The factory saved $200,000 that year on ideas proposed at the workout. Everybody gets caught up in this tremendous rush of adrenaline, a team leader at the plant, Bill DeMeo, said. The ideas that people come up with are so encouraging, it's unbelievable. These people get psyched. All their ideas are fair game. Then Kerr helped take the workout program company-wide. By 1994, every GE employee within GE had participated in at least one workout. As profits and productivity rose, executives at other companies began imitating the workout system inside their own firms. By 1995, there were hundreds of companies conducting workouts. Kerr joined GE full-time in 1994 and eventually became the company's chief learning officer. The workouts were successful because they balanced the psychological influence of immediate goals with the freedom to think about bigger things, said Kerr. That's critical. People respond to the conditions around them. If you're being constantly told to focus on achievable results, you're only going to think of achievable goals. You're not going to dream big. Workouts, however, weren't perfect. They took an entire day of everyone's time and usually meant the plant had to slow down production so that workers could all attend the meetings. It was something a division or plant could do once or twice a year at most. And though the workouts left everyone feeling excited and hungry for change, the effects were frequently short-lived. A week later, everyone was back at their old jobs and, often, their old ways of thinking. Kerr and his colleagues wanted to foster perpetual ambitions. How, they wondered, do you get people to think expansively all the time?